Somewhere men are laughing, and somewhere children shout, but there is no joy in Mudville. Mighty Casey has struck!
I only got one thing to say to you. Strike this mother out.
Two. He got a perfect game. And one done by the king.
Hey, you. Are you right there, apple?
Took away a game-tying home run for Manny Ramirez.
That's my thing, fellas.
We will see you tomorrow night.
Ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for visiting us this evening.
Brody, I think it's time to talk about what's happened over the past few days. You know, what's been on people's minds, really been the talk of the town, especially if you spend all day online. I'm talking, of course, about Peanut the Squirrel. Do you know anything about this yet?
It seemed to me that, like, some weird right-wing freaks co-opted this story somehow, and I have avoided the entire thing. So I'm kind of curious about what is going on.
I'm on the fence right now about Peanut the Squirrel. If you haven't caught up yet, in the state of New York, somewhere upstate, this guy and his wife, they have a bunch of strange animals that maybe you're not supposed to have. And there was an anonymous complaint that was filed against this squirrel and raccoon. They raided this guy's house for like 5 hours in search of a squirrel and a raccoon. And then they took the squirrel and raccoon and killed them. Which,
wait, what?
I think isn't great.
That's why?
It seems like a bit of an overstep on the part of the government here. If you watch the video, it just gets especially ridiculous. So if you don't mind, I'm just going to put this up, play this for the people.
Okay.
All right.
I had to get a police escort to my bathroom. I wasn't even allowed to feed my rescue horses breakfast or lunch. I was sat there. Like a criminal. After they interrogated my wife to check out her immigration status, then proceeded to ask me if I had cameras in my house, then proceeded to go through every cabinet, nook, and cranny of my house for a squirrel and a raccoon.
They got a search warrant?
They got a search warrant. 4 departments and a judge signed off on a search warrant for a squirrel and a raccoon. And then they took them and killed them.
Why did they go through all that?
That's pretty fucked up.
Why did they kill them?
I don't know. I feel like you can't just go into somebody's house, take their squirrel. Like, you know the line?
If you legally have a pet, let's say whatever it is, why is it that the response is then to kill the pet and not, like, give it to someone else? Or, like, or put it, release it into the wild or something? If it's, like, really a problem, A. B, that's not a problem. If you have, like, a little squirrel and, like, a little raccoon as a pet, I don't feel like that should be an issue.
You know the line from The Big Lebowski where Walter says, and keep in mind, dude, that owning a marsupial, an amphibious, that ain't legal either. And then the dude says, what are you, a fucking park ranger now? I don't know. It seems to me like I'm a little curious more about the raccoon because I feel like that's something that you kind of can't have. I'm a little bit less sympathetic towards the raccoon. But like either way, I mean, this is fucked up. This is like not something that we endorse on the podcast. Like, I think they should have let this guy's squirrel and probably the raccoon as well live and just kind of go back there. Like, it seems like that they kind of fucked up.
I mean, say what you want about the tenets of National Socialism, dude. At least it's an ethos.
Yeah.
And also, let's not forget, dude, that keeping wildlife, an amphibious rodent for, domestic within the city, that ain't legal either.
What, are you a fucking park ranger now?
No, I'm just trying
to
offer...
Who gives a shit about the fucking marmot?
We are sympathizing here, dude.
Fuck sympathy. I don't need your fucking sympathy, man. I need my fucking Johnson.
What do you need that for, dude?
You have got to buck up, man. You cannot drag this negative energy into the tournament.
Fuck the tournament. Fuck you, Walter.
This is where the guy kind of starts to lose me, and I need to know if I'm just being heartless or if this is a little bit ridiculous. Listen to the next thing he says.
Again, Peanut was an indoor squirrel not harming anybody. He's been with us for 7 years. Not a single complaint was ever filed for this animal. We had him for 7.5 years. He became the world's most famous squirrel. We weren't hiding him by any means. He was all over TikTok. He became the first squirrel on TikTok to ever hit 1 million followers. He did every news station around the world. He's helped people. He's helped kids gather joy. And then we started a nonprofit animal rescue called Peanuts Freedom Farm to help animals.
Okay, well, that last part is kind of sweet.
He's the first squirrel on Instagram to hit 1 million.
What are you talking about? Why is it that you're... Okay. Your pet squirrel died, and you're like, but he was so sick on the internet.
He helped millions of children, dude.
He was dope online.
Oh, my God.
How could they do this? What the hell is he talking about?
He was the first squirrel on TikTok to hit 1 million followers.
I don't do well with squirrels getting killed, I guess. It's not really funny. It's just like, that bums me out. There was a prank when I was in high school. When I was a junior in high school, there was a senior who brought a squirrel in to, like, set loose. And, like, that was the prank. And it was really stupid. Wasn't, like, creative at all. Just, like, literally brought it inside and then let it go. And the school safety cop or whatever on duty literally shot it. Like, they trapped it, brought it outside, and shot it.
Oh, my God.
And they
like with
did
a
that
gun?
Instead of just... Yeah, they did that instead of just letting it go.
They shot it with a gun?
They shot it. Yes.
What the fuck?
They took the squirrel and they shot it. I don't know why. I don't know why. I don't have an answer as to why.
What kind
Not
of gun?
Great, but, like, I'm sure just his pistol. Like, it was just, like, you know, heard about the fact that they brought it out and shot it. And... You know, why are cops shooting squirrels? Like, if they have a wild animal situation, just let it go. Like, it's the same thing. I don't get it. You don't have to go into this guy's house and kill their squirrel. That's bummed me out. I don't like that.
I think people are upset about this one because in this case, it wasn't the cops. It was, like, this government organization that took the squirrels and, like, made the decision to, like, kill the animals. And so now, and this is really, like, the reason that I'm bringing this up is that Republicans have caught onto the coattails of this situation and this, like, outrage that manifested on the internet and are now trying to make it a winning political issue, like, 2 days before the election.
That's what I've seen. So, like, how did this get co-opted? Like, what? It says, like, some dumb account with a peanut in the name and a blue check said, because Peanut is so incontrovertibly good, his killing is a Christ-like sacrifice. Humans are flawed, but this squirrel represented nothing but happiness. If you're in favor of killing Peanut, you can't be good. And if you are good, you can't stand with those who think killing Peanut is good. Who thinks that killing the squirrel is good?
Bro...
Like, who's getting up today and is like, they should have shot it with a bigger gun. Like, get the shotgun out. Leave nothing behind. Like, who's pro-killing the squirrel? And why is this a line that they're thinking is going to actually draw in votes?
Dude, I run into the shed looking for my flamethrower like Rick Dalton every time I see a chipmunk. J.D. Vance called it the Elon Musk of squirrels. What the fuck?
What does that mean? What does that mean?
I think their plan is to sort of vaguely gesture to the fact that it happened in a blue state, even though it like almost definitely wasn't a blue county. It was like one of those places that we drive between when we went from our hometowns to our college town. One of those
If it was upstate somewhere in the middle of nowhere,
full,
I mean, there's
full
a lot
Trump
of really
country.
Beautiful like, areas up there. They're very nice people. But there's also, for some reason, Confederate flags in upstate New York, and I don't understand that. So maybe that's what we're dealing with here.
There's a 90% chance that Peanut voted for Trump. I think that they assume that people are going to see this and act like Kamala shot the squirrel in the head herself. And, like, as usual, it's working only on the dumbest people out there.
They brought Peanut to Kamala and she put her thumb down and he was executed gladiatorial style.
Like Joaquin Phoenix. Oh my God. It's one of those things where like you only know about it if you spend way too much time online and you only know that it's a like conservative talking point now if you really spend too much time online. The chances of this affecting anything materially are zero. Election this Tuesday. We were set to make...
Shout out to Matthew Broderick.
Of course, dude. If you haven't listened to our election episode, that was a really great one with Eddie. I wanted to do more like that following it, and it didn't really happen. We're going to talk about that a little more later on the pod as well.
It might be happening soon.
We were set to make an endorsement, but of course, the billionaires who own this podcast said no.
They refused to let us.
You know what? Fuck them. I'm going to do it anyway. If you are an American, you have your civic duty, and this especially applies to you if you live in a big city. Go out there and see Clint Eastwood's Juror Number 2 in theaters now. We have to juice the numbers and say, fuck David Zaslav, who tried to kill this movie. They tried to suppress our boy, 94-year-old Clint Eastwood. It could be his last movie. People are saying it's really, really good. Full disclosure, I haven't seen it yet. I was going to go tonight, but we're recording the podcast. I'll be seeing it this week. If you're there, say hey to me. It's going to be a lot of fun. As an American, we have an obligation to follow one of our own. So this week of November 5th, do your part and go see Juror Number 2. Thank you very much.
Does he plow in this one?
I do not think he acts in this one. If you want to see him plow, you can watch The Mule. He has two threesomes in that one.
The John Mulaney and Pete Davidson bit about the mule is one of my favorite comedic bits in history. It does sound a little bit like an endorsement for knowing Clint Eastwood's history, although I think he might be too old to have opinions at this point.
I think Clint has given us enough quality films to supersede the reputation given to him by the chair incident. I think if Obama were here, he would say, "My fellow Americans, you have to go out and you have to see Juror Number 2. It's in theaters now."
Got a good Obama.
Oh, thank you. I don't do a very good Trump, though.
I don't think I do either.
It's no, mostly, you just kind of drop it. Okay. Voice. That's not bad. That's not bad.
It's I do a good impression of a late night host's impression of Trump, which is just, "Wow, look at this. What a fool. I walked in here. I said, look at this guy. He's such a fool." It's the same thing. This is, it's an important day. And I wanted to just say also, like, I hope you can listen on Election Day if you are, as a escape or a distraction, because I think, as I said earlier, I think we all need to kind of take a breath, and not to get all soapboxy or whatever, but Marathon Day in the city the other day was really cool, and it was just a nice reminder that, like, people in general are cool and nice, and I think that's a good thing to remember. Don't give in to the hopelessness that kind of comes with these days every couple of years. You know, just enjoy. We'll talk some baseball for you. We'll talk some movies. Unplug for a bit and enjoy.
Can you do CCH Pounder?
What kind of cops has they got working for the DA? I forget what she actually says, but I remember that from Philly or from Always Sunny.
That's my favorite show, dude. I've been going back and showing it to my girlfriend now for the first time, because she had never seen it, and we've been watching some of the old season 2 episodes that really are not the ones that I usually revisit. They're ones I hadn't seen in a while, and some of those are very funny. A few of them I'm like, oh god, can't believe they're on that one. But hey, for 2005 humor, I mean, it's like a 1.4 on the racism scale, so can't really.
It could be worse compared to a lot of things from the time.
It could be so much worse.
Wait, I need to look at the list of season 2 episodes.
The Gangos Jihad.
Really good ones in
that's,
here.
That's a banger. The
Gang Exploits a Miracle might be one of the best Gang Runs for Office classic. Oh, there's so many good ones.
That's where you
they
meet.
They go on welfare.
That's where you meet the priest, is the Exploits a Miracle, Cricket. It's where his first introduction, when he's like actually has his life. I think that's like the best season long gag I've ever seen on a sitcom, is like how effectively. Well, you know what I mean? Like many, like the way that they just effectively destroy his life and just turn him into the most depraved,
crack smoking hobo.
They sure do. That's an incredible show. We've been talking about dumb shit to distract from the fact that a lot of this podcast is going to be very sad and make us depressed.
I guess we probably should bring it up. Do you want to bring it up, or I'll bring it? I can bring it up. It was Halloween recently, and some very spooky stuff happened. There was a Nazi rally at MSG. I think that's what you're referring to. Is that what you're referring to?
I was going to ask what your costume was, actually.
For the rally or for Halloween? On Halloween. My girlfriend and I were the Wet Bandits from Home Alone, actually. It was very fun. Walked around the city with a crowbar. That was a little worrisome, honestly. Not a great call on my part, but we still had fun.
My girlfriend and I were Dirk Diggler and Roller Girl from Boogie Nights, which we enjoyed
that
a lot.
That was great.
Yeah, thank you very much. But yeah, no, that was fun. That's the last fun thing to talk about before. Folks, this is the Mudville Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Nolan Rabine.
I am your other host, Brody Staub.
And the New York Yankees lost the World Series in 5 games to the Los Angeles Dodgers, who celebrated in Yankee Stadium and had their parade the other day, watched as they launched into a new dynastic era, one that organization had been waiting to blossom into for quite some time. Folks, if you're listening to it at this point, you know all this. You know what happened. You watched the games, most likely. You saw Freddie Freeman's walk-off in Game 1. You saw his other home run in Game 2 and his home run in Game 3 and his home run in Game 4. You watched the series. I mean, you know what happened in the 5th inning of Game 5. I don't wish to reference it any further than that. We're all on the same page. But we're going to talk about where both of these teams go from here. The Dodgers seem to be in the best position I can remember any team being in my life, at least, going forward. And the Yankees have a lot of questions to answer in the offseason. But first, Brody, since this is our first time recording since the series ended, have you cooled off yet? Have your thoughts leveled out? Yeah. Or are you still just on the ledge every minute of every day?
Glad that I can say that, yes, I have cooled off since. I was not doing great after they lost the 3rd game. Because really, I mean, after they lost Game 5, everyone that was reaching out to me or whatever, because everybody knows that I'm a psycho for the Yankees, they're like, I'm so sorry, are you doing all right? I was like, this was over after Game 3. Like, that's how this works. You go down 3-0, it's over. I had some hope, quite foolishly, or not, and we could talk about why or not in a minute, but like, I thought maybe if they could just get it back to LA, that there was actually a better than non-existent chance that they could pull off this insane miracle and come back and at least force a Game 7 and we could have some fun. But instead, they got gentlemanly swept in 5 games and it was pathetic and they got embarrassed. And I really am okay now. I'm not happy with how the season ended, obviously, but there are plenty of other things to worry about and focus on right now, so that helps. Yeah, what really keeps on pissing me off, it's not like I remember that they lost and I'm like, you know, I have like a moment or whatever, like, or turn black and white or something. It's all the stuff that's been coming out that the Dodgers are saying about the Yankees for some reason. They keep on like just body slamming them while they're down. Joe Kelly today said something about how the Yankees were like the worst team in the playoffs. And also, Joe Kelly didn't even pitch in the playoff. What is he talking about? Why is he opening his mouth, first of all? Second of all, after they won, Kike Hernandez gets up on during the parade and says some stupid stuff about them. It's just like, I don't understand why we're all just fine with the Dodgers talking like the most shit for no reason after they won and beat the team. Like, where is the, you know, respect for your opponent or whatever? I would be upset if the Yankees had won and they had tried any of this. I'd be upset with any team that does this because it's really a bad look. It's like, it's pathetic. You look like a loser. Like, it's just because, you know, you won and now you're just being like a prick about it. Like, you just, you look lame. And I wish that that would stop. If their goal is to specifically get under my skin, then good job, I guess. But I don't know why you do that. You're a multi-millionaire baseball player who just won a World Series. Go enjoy your life. Why do you have to focus on the Yankees? I don't know. That really annoyed me. You know what? After that rant, maybe I'm not doing as well as I thought. Go on.
For me, there's a lot of middle ground between what Kike said and what Joe Kelly said. Like, Kike, he was basically like, he said, like, they started kicking the ball around and playing Yankee defense, which I think was sort of the sharpest jab that he threw at the Yankees as a whole.
If he's not careful, he's going to be a Yankee next season. So just, like, watch your mouth, man. Like,
and, you know, that one kind of pissed me off at first, too. But, like, ultimately, after thinking about it for a second, I've been like, well, you know what? The Yankees, for a very long time, have not prioritized defense. Like, organizationally, as a strategy, they have been okay with where we can sacrifice a few runs on that side of the ball because we're going to get so many guys who can mash that we're going to lead the league in home runs every season. And that is how
I just say, too, he's right. I want to point out.
No, he's absolutely right. No.
I know he is. I'm not in denial.
Kike is right. The Yankees played in that inning the worst defense I have ever seen a team play in one inning, and it came at the worst possible time in an elimination game and led to 5 unearned runs. If that won't change an organization's strategy, I don't know what will. But yeah, for a long time, the Yankees have not prioritized defense, so I think ultimately Kike saying that is pretty fair. Joe Kelly made himself look like an ass. And Joe Kelly was not on the World Series roster. He was not on any postseason roster. The only reason Joe Kelly has been on the team for so long is Dave Roberts has some weird love for him. Dodgers
just
fans,
likes former Red Sox.
Dodgers fans don't like him. Red Sox fans don't like him. Yankees fans don't like him. I mean, nobody likes Joe Kelly. He's just a wild pitcher that was not good enough to make his team's roster over guys that had barely seen any experience in Major League Baseball. So I think you can basically just ignore what he says.
The tiny bit of goodwill he earned when he threw at Altuve is like that lasted for 5 seconds.
Oh, boy.
I just miss when Tyler Austin beat the hell out of him, and I enjoyed that. And I would like to, if we could bring stuff like that happening more when guys talk like this, that would be great. Thanks. But more violence in baseball.
Bring more violence to the game.
I'm going to run for president on that platform specifically. I'm going to tell Rob Manfred to stop banning people for fighting. If they want to fight, let them. Make it like hockey. More entertaining.
I'm a single issue voter, and it is the hockeyfication of baseball.
100%.
Yeah. Why don't we get into the Dodgers first, seeing as they are the team that won? I got a lot to say about it myself, sort of how we got here, sort of where we're going, but I'll kick it to you first. What are the initial things that you think about when you think about this Dodgers season, the fact that it resulted in a championship, and just where they're at moving forward?
Sure. Well, first, I would just like to read off their free agents going into this offseason, if you'll let me. We've got Teoscar Hernandez, Jack Flaherty, Blake Treinen, Enrique Hernandez, Kike Hernandez, Clayton Kershaw, Joe Kelly, Walker Buehler. Now, to the fans' ear, you hear those names, and you notice that is like all of the guys that contributed to them winning the World Series, minus Freddie Freeman and Mookie Betts. Maybe a little concerning if you're a Dodger fan, but if you're a Dodger fan, you also know that they're more than willing to go spend a ton of money. Also, most of those guys are 37 years old, so whatever on a few of them. They did offer Teoscar Hernandez a qualifying offer today. The rest of them, though, there's a lot of pieces in there that you probably won't be seeing back next year. But then you also have Shohei Ohtani going back to the pitcher's mound on opening day next year, most likely. They're going to need a lot of pitching, so you can expect them to go after Corbin Burns. Maybe you can see them go for Max Fried. Wouldn't be surprised if they went for Snell or Jack Flaherty, one of those more mid-end guys. Andrew Heaney was just there. He pitched well recently. As a Dodger, Nathan Eovaldi is on the market. There's some names that I wouldn't be surprised to see them go after where they like a name. There's a lot of names on the market. Wouldn't be shocked. The pitching market in general is really good. We can get into that. Expect them to go after some pitching. The lineup, I think they're more than fine. They're good defensively. They have one of the best farm systems in baseball. They are terrifying for the future. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to start with the Dodger lineup. They were able to win a World Series in 5 games with Shohei Ohtani's shoulder popping out on every swing, essentially, and rendering him almost useless, which is pretty unbelievable. You know, they just have the next man up type deal where you can't avoid Ohtani because then you have Mookie Betts, and you can't avoid Mookie Betts, because you have Freddie Freeman after that. I think a lot of people going into the series expected Freeman might struggle a bit because he apparently had some ankle injury and that Otani would go absolutely nuclear. It ended up
did have a bad ankle, by the way.
Apparently, like, yeah. I mean, it
healed in the week off.
Absolutely. It ended up being the complete opposite of that, where, you know, we said going into the series, whoever had the superstar with the best performance was going to win the series, and Freddie Freeman almost single-handedly won this series for the Dodgers with the way he played. So yeah, it's like I said, I think, I don't know if it's hyperbolic to say that I think that the Dodgers right now are in the best position any team really has ever been in. You're paying Shohei Ohtani $2 million a year for the next like 10 years at this point. You're getting the entire prime of the best player who has ever touched the ball, dominant on both sides. You know, you can't say enough about Ohtani.
Luxury tax is 46, though, just to say.
They're going to have that core for a very long time. You know, I think they're going to do everything that they can to bring Teoscar Hernandez back. If they're not able to do that, they will certainly supplement the team with other veteran free agents. And really the key for the Dodgers is their developmental pipelines, because they are always able to pop out a pitcher like a Gavin Stone or an Emmett Sheehan, one of these guys who wasn't like a top prospect, but they're able to turn into one, and then these guys are able to find success at the big leagues. Interestingly, all of those guys seem to be hurt this year for the Dodgers. They didn't have any of them healthy. This could even be the worst Dodger team that we see for like the better half of a decade. And that is a terrifying thought, the fact that they only had three starters. They didn't have Tyler Glass now. Shohei Ohtani wasn't pitching this year, you know. And they just handily won this series, and they beat every team. You know, they beat the Padres. They were able to catch up to them. They handled the Mets, and then yeah, they really beat the Yankees. So and it wasn't like dominant. You know, the offensive performances were pretty similar. The Yankees really lost this series both on defense and on the base paths. My God, I mean, when you think about what the Dodgers are going to look like in a few years, I mean, they always have guys
and
that,
offensively and in the starting pitching game.
Of course. I mean, they always have guys that are on the verge of being top 10 prospects, like Zaire Hope's values currently skyrocketing in the Arizona Fall League. Josue DePaula, I think, is going to develop into a really good player. Yoendry Vargas. And I mean, it helps that they seem to be the go-to team for all of the Japanese superstars who come over to Major League Baseball. Like, I mean, we knew Ohtani was coming over in free agency. Like, I mean, in hindsight, it seems very obvious that they were the only team that Yamamoto was going to go to. And I mean, who knows what's going to happen when Munetaka Murakami and Roki Sasaki come over in a few years? Like, are the Dodgers going to be the only?
That would be unfair.
Yeah, no, and it's
unfair. And like, there's no way.
There is a way though, because like, are they?
I know there is. That's the scariest part.
Are the Dodgers going to be the only team on those guys' list? Like, that seems plausible at this point. Like, I don't know where else they're gonna go if they also want to play on like the West Coast. Like, I mean, I don't know. I hope I'm not like stereotyping Japanese players
out of Japanese.
I don't know,
out of Japan. Yeah,
maybe
the Yankees have a good history of signing players out of Japan too. So it's possible that they only end up wanting to go to the Dodgers. Seattle, like Ichiro is still a star. You know, even like over there, they still love him. So like, it's not impossible that there are other teams that would be on their list. I mean, there was a part of the whole Yamamoto thing where they said, you know, maybe he wants to go carve his own path and, you know, under the shadow of Ohtani. I think he's like beyond that. It's not like playing with another superstar. It's like going to play with baseball Jesus. It's like, you know, I don't think that they would see it as a negative to have to be under his shadow. I think he kind of just is more of a bigger figure than just a regular ball player.
Ultimately, this is going to be seen as the year that the Dodgers officially turned into a dynasty. I would not be surprised to see them win like three more rings before 2030 at this point. They're certainly going to be one of the final contenders every year. Until then, now that Ohtani has a World Series ring, I can see him getting many more. And Mookie Betts has already said he wants to fill up his hand because he's already got three. The term generational is overused these days, but it truly applies to Mookie Betts. That's a guy that I wish was on my team.
With these teams where the narrative is they can't get it done in October, they don't show up in a big spot or whatever, you just really have to do it once, and then that's gone.
Absolutely.
So if they fall apart next year in the playoffs, maybe not so much, but I don't think we'll be hearing that again. Moving on to the team that did just do that.
Yes. What
oh boy.
Do you think is the future of the New York Yankees? What is the immediate plan? And how do we view this season now that it is in the rearview mirror?
Great question. You know what? Like the Dodgers, I'll go over their free agents for the upcoming offseason. Start with the big one, Clay Holmes. No, let's start with Juan Soto, obviously, the 26-year-old megastar. They did offer him a qualifying offer, so, you know, fingers crossed, maybe he'll take that, 21.1 for the year. But you've got Juan Soto, Gleyber Torres, Clay Holmes, Alex Verdugo, Tim Hill, Jonathan Loaisiga, Tommy Kahnle, Anthony Rizzo, J.D. Davis, and Lou Trevino also are counted in this list.
What about Hicks?
Aaron Hicks is officially off the books. I think he would count as maybe Baltimore's free agent. I'm not sure. But yeah, Aaron Hicks is finally coming off the books. Where do the Yankees go from here is a very tough question, because really it all starts and kind of, I don't want to say it starts and ends, but it definitely starts and severely changes with Juan Soto. If they go get Juan Soto, then I don't know how much else they will do, considering that between Soto being at, let's say, $46 million. My prediction, by the way, for Soto, we can get into another time. I do think he's going to end up somewhere probably higher than Ohtani's $46 million a year for about 14, 15 years. I could see him getting 50 for 15, which would put him at 650. I could see him getting, I had a number the other day that was like 46 and a half for 13 years or something like that, or maybe it was 15.
Let's do like the math. It official was, free agent predictions next week.
Yeah, we will. Anyway, my point being was just that it's going to be a massive contract, somewhere around $40 to $50 million a year, most likely. I don't think a team will go much higher than that. But if it is, let's say, so that's $50 million for Soto, that's $40 million for Judge, that's $36 million for Cole, that's $27 million for Stanton or something like that, and then $27 million for Rodon. That's $180 million. So between those few guys, you're at $180 million already. Hal Steinbrenner said he doesn't think they need a $300 million payroll to compete. I don't necessarily disagree, except when Brian Cashman is your general manager, he tends to do that. So, you know, we'll see if they want to keep payroll a little bit lower. $180 million split between those five or six guys that I just mentioned is a ton of money focused on a very small percentage of your team when you need 26 guys. You can't have that many making that much money and then not expect to spend a crap ton more to then fill it up with representative players around them. So if they don't end up getting Soto, I can see them making a lot of moves for, you know, I think it starts with Alex Bregman. I think that's the first place you look. That's the best place to go upgrade your team at a better, quote-unquote, price than whatever Soto is going to get. I don't think Bregman is going to be getting a $400 million deal or a $300 million deal. Compared to Soto's, you know, almost $700 million deal. So you can start there. It all comes down to whether or not Soto ends up back in New York, but the Yankees have to do a very quick pivot. I said earlier, maybe Kike Hernandez, you can go get him and stick him in left field. You can stick him at third. You can stick him in the infield, anywhere else. He shows up in the biggest spots, as we just saw. If he'd be willing to come here, I actually really wouldn't hate it, other than hating him as, you know, a guy who talked crap about my team. That's somewhere I wouldn't mind looking. As far as the age of free agents, the reason that I start with guys like that, there aren't a ton of young ones. So, you know, as I said earlier too, the pitching market is pretty good. If you want to go after Corbin Burns, you can. But there's really not a lot of young free agents. Eloy Jimenez is 28. He's an option, I guess, if you want to bat. Verdugo is another one who's on the younger side at 29. Other than that, you're really hard pressed to find a free agent that's going to be young that you can spend a lot of money on. Willie Adames and Jack Flaherty are both 29. They're, you know, some of the better ones this offseason too. Both of them, I think, could help the team. I wouldn't see Willie Adames moving off a shortstop, but they need defense, and they need defensive help bad, and Willie Adames can hit. So, like, those, you know, they need a lot. Juan Soto is not the only thing they need. They also need bullpen help. Tanner Scott is on the market. There's a lot of places you can go that they're going to really need to do a lot and get creative with the money that they have available to them. I mentioned that 180, they also have a ton of other money wrapped up everywhere else. So I think they mostly likely will be starting from around a probably close to 250 as a starting point, maybe a little bit higher. And if they want to stay under a tax threshold, excuse me, that's going to be impossible. So you're going to see a lot of their prospects. You're going to see Spencer Jones, Jason Dominguez. You might end up seeing some young pitchers who we don't know much about yet. So we'll see. It's going to be a weird offseason with the whole Soto sweepstakes. And then next season, you just kind of have to hope goes well, because that's probably going to be what the team looks like for a little bit.
For me, it does really start and end with Juan Soto, because when you think back to when they acquired him, you know, the first thought was, okay, this gives the team home field advantage, so to speak, when free agency comes to pass. And where I'm kind of at is, if he comes back and he signs a long-term contract and they have him as a Yankee for life, last season becomes a success and the World Series loss becomes a lot easier to stomach, because you can think of 2024 as a proof of concept pitch to the player that you have been waiting to get on your team for many, many years in some form. Like, you know, it wasn't even Soto specifically for a long time. It was Bryce Harper, Manny Machado, at least in the eyes of fans, you know, some star that you could put out there and pair with Aaron Judge and be this dynasty team that the Yankees are capable of being and that all of their fans expect them to be. So if you're able to prove to Juan Soto this team can win, Soto just provided the team with their most euphoric moment in over a decade, then it's all a success and you can build from there and you have the template to really create a long-term winner. Like, your window at that point is just wide open and no one has any chance of closing it, really, because you'd have Cole now, as of today, locked up again for 4 more years. You'd have Judge long term, and you'd have Soto long term. You'd have Jazz Chisholm for 2 more years. You'd have Stanton for, I believe, 2 more years. You'd have Jason Dominguez on his rookie contract, and you build from there. Like, I think that's a better situation than 27 or 28 teams in baseball. Really, just not the Dodgers and maybe not the Braves, depending on how their health is next year. So, and if Soto leaves, then you find yourself struggling to pivot to plan B, because you gave up so much pitching to get him that you're kind of stranded with a lackluster staff and maybe with a lackluster lineup as well, that you're probably going to see a lot of guys pitched to around Aaron Judge while teams just point him over to first base. And that's what you have to avoid. So I don't know exactly what plan B would look like if they're not able to get Juan Soto back. Like, if you need immediate bats and you want to plug those holes instantly, you probably go for, like, Pete Alonso, maybe a stack of Christian Walker, Teoscar Hernandez. I don't know. Personally, I'm of the mindset that you go all in on Kyle Tucker in 2026, try to get him on your team because his contract is expiring. And maybe the Astros aren't able to pay him. I don't know.
I'd be surprised if they don't retain one of Bregman or Tucker. I mean, maybe. I don't think Bregman is he's 31. I wouldn't be shocked if the Astros gave him like a short deal and he wanted to stay. But it would be a hard sell to their fan base not to keep Tucker.
Yeah, I mean, frankly, I don't see the Yankees in the World Series again without Soto. You know, maybe I'm wrong because I think the AL is pretty weak right now. Like, I don't know how many other teams I see the Yankees against in a series and think, oh, that other team is the heavy, heavy favorite. There really isn't a team like that. So maybe they do it without him, but I would be much, much less excited about the next decade of Yankee baseball if Soto signs elsewhere, because I don't think they're going to be able to replace him at all. I'm not confident in the organization or really any organization's ability to do that, because that's not a guy that you can replace. Any number that the bald man in Queens presents with, you have to match.
I wouldn't be shocked if what happens is he gets offers from everybody, goes back to the Yankees, because I think he did like it there. And I think he would be willing to, you know, at least just tell them what other teams are offering and just say, this is what is on the table. Are you willing to match it? And if he is able to get that from the Yankees, I think he might end up coming back. I just worry that it's going to be a ridiculous amount of money from the bald man in Queens. Another thing with the Dodgers being this good and being in this position, we hear so much about how baseball on a year-to-year basis changes, you know, the landscape is vastly different than it was the year before, or, you know, like the playoffs are a crapshoot. It's hard to recreate success and, you know, all these things. The Dodgers could very well, as you said, win a few more rings before 2030. And they just did it by going after talent. And, I mean, when you see Mookie Betts and Freddie Freeman getting teamed up, it's like, damn, that's a good team. And then, you know, why don't we just go ahead and add in the best baseball player on the planet and throw him into the leadoff spot? And, oh, yeah, he'll also be our opening day starting pitcher. Like, all they did was go after the most talented baseball players and not worry about money. And even then, like, yes, their payroll is, like, super, super high. The Yankees' payroll is very similar. So if you're Brian Cashman, I think it makes for some fair questions about why they're so much better than you when you have a similar amount of resources and you are supposed to be in the same kind of league with this kind of team. I'm not advocating for, like, the big market teams to go blow out the little guys or whatever.
You know, I am.
We've done a lot of talking about how every team could spend more. But I also just don't want it to be, like, where the teams that spend the most win all the time, because then that's, like, not as fun either, because you want there to be some parity and you want there to be some actual interesting storylines or whatever, and it's not just, like, the higher payroll wins. At the same time, if you're a team that pretends to be a giant, big, bad boy team and you get embarrassed in the World Series by an actual big, bad boy team, then you need to do a lot to go fix that.
I absolutely agree. Ultimately, if this Dodger team changes the template of winning across Major League Baseball, I think that would be a very good thing. I mean, especially after seeing so many owners cry poor and sit on their hands over the past, like, 10 years, just not spend any money and think, hey, maybe if we draft enough good guys, we'll get there with the, like, $80 million payroll. That is not how you can win anymore. It's just not going to happen. And if we just start seeing continued success like this and organizations hand out contracts that don't completely blow up in their face like it did with Albert Pujols or with, I don't know, Miguel Cabrera or Anthony Rendon. Yeah, happened to the Angels like 6 times. I mean,
yeah, really did.
Yeah, the Dodgers are setting a very good precedent that I am very happy to see succeed. Just made me very sad that it was against my team.
It's a good way to put it. I might just be a little upset. I know it's a good thing for baseball in the long run. It just bugs me right now.
Yeah.
Mainly because the Yankees claim that they are the same thing, and it is so clear they're not. They don't play fundamental baseball, and whatever. We don't have to do the whole thing. It's been done. But I think we could also probably do to move on. But, you know.
For two teams that are supposed to be each other's bi-coastal mirror, the differences were just clear as day. I mean, one team did all of the little things right, and the other team tripped over their feet and made a clowns of themselves.
One team's game plan was expecting the other team to make mistakes and then capitalize when they do, not if. And it worked. And it's that is... That should stick with the front office for a while, and I think hopefully inspire some change if you want to take a positive out of it.
Absolutely. I think that's about all we have to say about the 2024 World Series. I'm more than happy to move on and start thinking about next week's free agency predictions. But that kind of leads me into the next thing. I kind of want to zag for a second and just sort of talk about, like, where we want to go, you know, now that the season's over.
Thinking Japan for vacation, maybe Italy.
Yeah, dude, I might go to Guam. I don't know. I've
hell yeah.
Yeah.
Beach.
Be nice. And sort of just, like, talk about the state of, like, the pod as a whole. We started this when we lived together, and it was a very different time for us, you know, personally and professionally. And we were in very different places than we are now. And when we started this, like, we wanted it to be the podcast about baseball and film. And, like, this year it really has only been baseball. And I've been like wondering if that has kind of confused or alienated some people. And like, I know how hard it's been for you, especially like to find any time at all to do anything this year, like, you know, much less spend 3 hours in a dark movie theater. So in addition to being much busier myself than I was last year, like I haven't wanted to put any pressure on you or like bother you too much at a very chaotic time. I didn't want you to be coming home from work at like 4 a.m. and then I'm texting you like, yo, did you watch this movie from 1947 yet?
No, I mean, it's, yeah, and I appreciate that. And it has been hectic, but it's, I think, changing for the better. So it's a good time to bring it up. And I think right now our fans should know that we're making a concerted effort to bring more of a balance back to that, at least for the off season specifically. And, you know, and once we get back to baseball season, we were going to try to, or, you know, we can certainly try to go back to our older format of like making sure that we have a movie to talk about, you know, here and there when there's not much going on in baseball. And especially just because we have a lot of fun talking about movies. And some of our more fun episodes, I think, that we have are, especially the ones with staying power, the ones about movies. So, as we mentioned earlier, with Election, by the way, which go watch that.
Yeah.
or go listen to that. Go watch it, too. Good movie, but go
great
listen to
movie.
That episode.
I think a lot of things put together resulted in us doing fewer episodes this season, had like a narrower focus to them. And like I realize now, it's been a long time since we talked about a movie on the pod. And I've totally missed it. Like you said, like I have like so much fun doing that. So this is not at all to say that like we're going to continue that trend and only be a baseball podcast from now on. Like it's actually the opposite. Now that we're in the off season, like my attention has been turning to a lot of the movies that I missed in theaters during the summer. I didn't really get a chance to kind of make that off-season transition last year just because like such a tough time for us both, and it started and it just kind of, we weren't able to do as many movies as we wanted. We have got so much planned now for the future of the pod. Now that the playoffs are done, you know, we're going to be doing free agent predictions, hypothetical trades next week. We're going to spread out next year's previews too and take it division by division, so we're not hitting you guys with two like 3 hour episodes. Right. We're gonna kind of space them out. I think that's gonna be a much better way of doing it. I would like to be writing more fantasy baseball content moving forward, updating prospect rankings, doing first year player draft, dynasty rankings. All that's going to be available on the Mudville Patreon, which we would like to make an effort as well to put more content on there as well. You know, everything
specifically for our subscribers.
Of course. Yeah. And, you know, everything on there has been totally free. We'd like to, you know, take it up a notch at some point. But, you know, for this year in particular, haven't really been able to do so, but stuff is on the way. So like we said, totally free if you want to sign up for when that happens, patreon.com/mudville. And like, I don't know about you, but I felt the urge lately to sort of expand the margins of the show and like discuss some other sports as well. Like I've want to talk about football, basketball going on.
Football for sure. One of my most passionate interests, I guess, is music, which, you know, I've been trying to figure out a lane to kind of bring that into.
I would love that, dude. If you have like any new albums coming out, any album recommendations that you want to talk about, we can totally make like a side corner for that. Like I wanted to talk about a book recently. We could add that to one episode. I'm not going to do it this week just because we're kind of running over. But so yeah, we can just, we're just going to talk about the stuff that we like because this is our podcast and nobody pays us and we can do whatever the hell we want. So
yeah.
If you're listening and you have anything that you want to hear, if you have a movie that you want to hear us talk about or an album that you want to hear or a book recommendation or anything, hit us up. mudvillepod@gmail.com. I'm going to start checking that. If you have any letters to us, we will totally read those. I mean, it'd be a lot of fun. So we're going to have a lot more fun with the pod moving forward. Sort of an apology just for being a little disheveled, I guess, these past few months. Then as well as a little baseball heavy. We really want to make this into something special. And I think 2025 is going to be a big year for us. Do you have anything else to say in that regard?
Well, yeah, as I mentioned, also just bringing up like music and more movie stuff. I, instead of watching football yesterday, Today's Monday. Yesterday was Sunday. Girlfriend and I decided to kind of lean into the whole fall vibe, and we watched The Nightmare Before Christmas and Home Alone.
Ooh.
We had a back-to-back kind of thing. Well, I actually watched The Nightmare Before Christmas at work the other day. We watched some of it together, and then we watched Home Alone. It was fantastic. And I wanted to talk about the scores of those movies. As I mentioned, I love music. Been doing a lot of music theory research, self-teaching recently, trying to become a better guitar player, piano player, a bunch of that kind of stuff. But I like the scores of those two movies specifically are so wonderful. And with a movie like The Nightmare Before Christmas and like Home Alone that are trying to do such specific things, the scores are like they just blend in so seamlessly. And I feel like we take scoring for granted so often, especially with The Nightmare Before Christmas, which is almost an opera. Honestly, it is like just so important to the feel of an entire movie. And Home Alone would be not nearly as heartwarming or as effective in its storytelling or have the staying power that it does without an incredible score from John Williams, who should be remembered as literally one of the best composers in history. His themes are beautiful and they stay with you. They are effective and they are iconic in every sense of the word, in the way that Ode to Joy is iconic. Like, composers who used to be commissioned by the church to make their music are now being commissioned by movie studios to make their music and make their compositions and their, you know, symphonies. And it does not take away from the fact that they are still fantastic composers. They should be thought of in similar veins. And I'm not saying Danny Elfman, who did the music for Nightmare Before Christmas, is similar to John Williams in that, but he is a very good composer. And The Nightmare Before Christmas has an extremely atmospheric score, pulls you into this world immediately, and it's like just, it's perfect. It is like incredible in the way that it just sets the scene and it brings you in and you kind of instantly get it and what they're going for and you can see where it's going. And he also does like all of Tim Burton's other things, so he's just really good at this kind of dark, you know, as I said, atmospheric, like, score that just punches you in the right way and makes you feel like the, you know, the angst that's going on in Tim Burton's world. And John Williams is, as I said, just the best. So I had a nice day of just enjoying some nice movies and some nice music and kind of setting the tone for the holiday season that's coming. But yeah.
I like the idea of, like, the Church of Sergio Leone hitting up Ennio Morricone and commissioning him to just make the greatest film scores of all time. That'd be pretty sick.
Man. And musicians have always been broke. That was, like, how they used to make their money. It was just, like, the church wanted to have the best musicians making their music. So there was, like, there's a whole cool history about, like, tritones, which were banned. It's just, like, a chord that wasn't allowed because they thought it was the devil's tone. It's, like, there's really cool stuff. And then the music that Mozart would make on his own, I don't know if you've ever heard this, it's, like, crazy. Like, he had one song that was, like, what the hell was it called? It was, like, I Hate You, You Stink, or something. It was, like, Mozart's personal music was hilarious. Like, it's just funny that, like, you know, composers in general, I think, have this weird lofty, they're separate or whatever, but we still have great ones, and they're just working on movies now instead of making those kinds of symphonies.
We should do a composer draft at some point where we each draft a team of five composers and make them face off on the court.
Give me Beethoven. He seemed like a dick.
I like the idea of movie studios as churches, though. Unfortunately, it'd probably have the same number of pedophiles, but
and they get protected. Yeah, because they have all the money.
I would love to know more about film scores. I mean, I have some of my personal favorites, but it's never really been like an aspect of cinema that I have known quite as much about as others. So I'd love to hear more if you have any more film score recommendations or just, you know, you want to start digging more into that. I think that would be super cool.
One that just sticks out in my mind, I mean, like, just a moment from There Will Be Blood that sticks with me is just, like, how mechanical. I would need to go back and look at it, but it was just, like, I remember specifically thinking while watching it, like, this is just, it's perfect. Like, it was incredible.
Johnny Greenwood's scores for Paul Thomas Anderson are incredible.
Yeah.
I love them all. I believe he did the one for You Were Never Really Here, too, the Lynn Ramsey movie with Joaquin Phoenix. I might be mistaken about that, but he has done a number of really good film scores, so Yeah, I mean, obviously incredibly talented musician. Not a very hot take to say Radiohead good.
It's definitely, I mean, oh, he won for best composer. Oh, at the Broadcast Film Critics Association. But he won for best composer somewhere. So,
well, that's good.
Nominated for best sound editing. I was just trying to see if it won anything. It's an underrated aspect of the art that is cinema, if I could be a little snobby for a second. It's very easy to just not appreciate it and take it as just being there. That is, I mean, the best ones, I think, make you not even question it. But it's the little things, just the little thematic, you know, twinkles that let you know a character is on stage or on stage, on screen, or like what their intentions are. You know, just little things like that that set the scene that are beautiful. I don't need to defend good scoring, I don't think. But it is just, it's a beautiful art that I would love to talk about some more. If one, you know, if we watch something that it sticks out, it'd be fun to talk about.
That'd be great. Well, I guess I will sort of get us to the finish line here this week. Like I said, I've been watching quite a few movies that I had not seen over the summer. I have caught up with like Janet Planet, I thought was particularly cute, I guess. La Chimera, I'm pronouncing that wrong. The Alicia Rohrwacher movie was really good. Hundreds of Beavers wasn't really my thing. I say this to say that there are a few movies that I am setting aside to sort of talk about more in long form, either with you or with Tony, but there are a couple as well that I'm not going to dedicate that much time to, but I do just want to make a couple of notes on because that's all I really care about for them. Particularly the Joker sequel, Folie à Deux, I think is the French pronunciation of it. So already,
it's probably something
you know,
like
with that title. You know, it's a movie that right off the bat you sort of heard was a rebuke of the first movie's success and a big middle finger to the fans and the like executives alike. And like, I'm not opposed to that on principle. Like, I think it's kind of funny, and especially in this climate and this like economy of movie making, you know, and what gets distributed, what gets put on theaters just in New York City and Los Angeles, and what goes to 500 theaters across the country. I don't know. And especially in the past decade of like superhero movie making, I am not remotely opposed to somebody getting a $200 million budget and saying, I'm going to make the exact opposite of what you think you're going to get. I'm even going to make the opposite of what you want because you don't know what you want. I know what you want. And if they pull that off, like that's something I think could be very, very interesting. Like you could even carve out a bit of artistry in a genre, if you want to call it that, at this point of movies that has become particularly stale. So conceptually, like I think, you know, that could have been cool. Like it could have been a really interesting idea. The problem is the execution of the movie is just not remotely interesting. Like you still have to like the movie you're making, and I don't get the sense that Todd Phillips likes this movie at all. Like if it's just a joke, it gets very stale. Like at some point, you know, there has to be something else behind it. Like you still have to be saying something with this movie, and to me it played like a suicide note from a guy that I didn't particularly like or find very interesting. And that's a tough thing to sit with for over 2 hours. There are some things that I definitely liked about it. Like I think that they got the Lady Gaga character right in the sense that they make her this like rich Upper East Side girl who like lies about her backstory and is only like cosplaying as mentally ill in this facility that she checked herself into, but of course he is in because he was arrested. And like those stakes of just this not being anything real and just this character being something totally artificial, I think is the right idea behind it. She feels to me like she'd be one of those like e-girls that's really into like Donald Trump and like Hegel for some reason.
I see the type.
So that kind of worked, but like it's also accurate, like if you want to say that this is the least appealing Joker movie possible, like if you're a comic book fan or if you just want to see the like Dark Knight again, you know, it's basically just a back and forth between him being abused in prison and derided in the courtroom. And you don't really get any escape from that. It's just sort of misery over and over. You have all the characters from the first movie come back, and say what happened to them, like in case the audience forgot. They just sort of recall their stories, and eventually the
like
Joker.
Like the Seinfeld finale.
Yeah, no, exactly. It basically, it's like that and the trial of Tim Heidecker, but I don't think it's as good as either of those things. Like, eventually the Joker fires his lawyer, played by Catherine Keener, and starts representing himself and puts the makeup back on and starts doing a foghorn, leghorn accent for, like, 5 minutes straight. That I got to chuckle out of that. But the, like, musical stuff that is one of the main selling points of the movie just doesn't work at all. Like, I don't think there's a single original song in the movie. Like, they're just singing like the most like basic, you know, Frank Sinatra sort of like big band type songs, like That's Life. I can't even remember any of the other examples right now, but it's just like, you know, the songs that you would expect to hear, ironically, like that are just, if they aren't public domain, they like might as well be at this point. And it doesn't add anything to the characters or to the plot, and like a lot of the time that's not something that I would really care about, but in this movie I think it kind of had to, and it didn't. And I'm not going to spoil the ending of the movie, but it's interesting for sure. You know, give me something like this over bland, like, Marvel crap like The Eternals. But at the same time, I mean, I'm just going to start skipping anything that has anything to do with a superhero, because, like, even this isn't very interesting to me anymore. I don't know.
A music in, or a movie musicals can be done really well, not to now really kind of double down on my music point, but like if you look at like a La La Land or like A Star Is Born Again, or I'm trying to think of like or like, okay, Chicago, which won Best Picture in 2003, really good, and that's based off an actual Broadway musical, which that doesn't go well usually. You know, it can be done well, and it doesn't have, like, it, you can make it interesting. Like, I mean, La La Land is very atmospheric, and it has, like, I keep on using that word. It's, like, it's very kind of surreal in certain ways. So
it's dreamlike.
Like, it can be done. Like, it's, yeah. Like, it can be done. You can do, like, a genre musical and not have it feel completely strange. It's possible. But I guess, you know, there has to be, like, a... Like, you can't have one foot out the door of doing it. It sounds like that's kind of where this is. Like, they're not sure what they're going for. I haven't seen the movie. I should preface.
yeah, that's okay. You don't need to.
It's odd, because the first one is great, and it's a bummer, because Lady Gaga also is... I like that she's now doing movies, because it opens the door for, like, really kind of cool musical, like, movie musicals.
I didn't know you were a big Joker 1 head.
It's a good movie. I just enjoy it. Like, it's, you know, I mean, I've only seen it like once. I'm just saying the first one was, it was interesting beyond just like a regular, obviously, superhero movie, but just like as a take on a familiar character, like it did something different. So it's like, if this at least tried to do something different again, it just might not have worked. Like, that's okay, I guess. It's just kind of disappointing.
Well, I think that's probably going to do it for us this week. Yeah. Unless you've got anything else, but I think I'm good.
No, I like talking about movies. It's nice to get back to.
More movie talk coming up soon. We've got some fun guests coming up, some fun films lined up to discuss. So much coming up on Mudville. You can go sign up for
and
free.
And some good baseball offseason stuff coming.
Oh, yeah. Free agency predictions. Going to cook up some hypothetical trades. And then, of course, discuss what actually happens and who signs where and gets traded to whom. It's going to be a lot of fun. Sign up for free to get notified for all of it at patreon.com/Mudville. I have been one of your hosts, Nolan Rabine.
I've been your other host, Brody Stout.
And we will see you all in a week. Goodbye.
That's life. That's life. That's what all the people say. You're riding high in April, shut down in May. But I know I'm gonna change that tune. When I'm back on top in June, I said that's life. And as funny as it may seem, some people get their kicks stopping on a dream. But I don't let it get me down. Cause this fine old world, it keeps spinning around. I've been a puppet, a polka, a pirate, a poet, a pawn and a king. I've been up and down and over and out, and I know one thing. Each time I find myself flat on my face, I pick myself.